Good afternoon. Delighted to welcome you all here for our third case this morning and third case on the October calendar, 2013 AP 1392, Runsheimer International Limited versus David Friedman. Arguing on behalf of Runsheimer International is Michael B. Apfeld, Attorney Apfeld, and arguing on behalf of David Friedland is Jeffrey M. Rosen. You are going to be introduced by Attorney Daniel Barker. Would you do that now, please?
May it please the Court, my name is Daniel Barker. I'm an attorney with the Madison Office of Constangi, Brooks & Smith. I'm a Wisconsin bar member. I'm introducing today Mr. Jeffrey Rosen, who's an attorney who's been admitted pro hoc vice in this case by the trial court. He's a member in good standing of the Massachusetts Bar, and he will be arguing on behalf of the respondents today.
Thank you, counsel. The pro hoc vice status will continue for this case in this court. Mr. Apfeld.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Apfeld, and together with Michael Hoytink, who is seated at counsel table, we represent Runsheimer International. This is an action by Runsheimer to enforce a restrictive covenant that defendant David Friedland signed during the course of his employment, but after he had been employed with Runsheimer for several years. The trial court held that because Friedland was an at-will employee and could in theory have been fired any time after he signed the covenant, any consideration for his agreement was illusory. Now, there are two undisputed facts that are paramount to the determination of this case. The first is that Mr. Friedland would have been fired had he not executed the covenant. And the second is that he was not, in fact, fired, and that Runsheimer continued to employ Friedland for over 2 years after he executed it. There are, in turn, three established principles of Wisconsin law that are determinative here. The first is that a promise of initial at-will employment is sufficient consideration to support a covenant not to compete. The second is that for all contracts, no new consideration is needed to modify an existing executory contract. And the third principle is that even where consideration is lacking at the inception of the agreement, it still becomes enforceable if, as here, the parties subsequently perform and accept the other's performance. Application of these principles to these facts compels the conclusion that this covenant was supported by legal consideration.
Counselor, don't we look at whether there was consideration at the time the contract was formed? Your third premise seems to say we don't.
Actually, Your Honor, in the Obie case, this Court held, which was not an employment case, but nevertheless a case dealing with an illusory or allegedly illusory promise, the Court held that you actually look at the sufficiency of the consideration at the time the party is seeking to enforce the contract. And if that is the rule in this case, then we clearly have 2 years of consideration that were given in exchange for his promise.
So there can be no consideration initially. And if you enforce it, and in the interim consideration has been provided, then you still enforce it.
That is our position, and it is well supported in Wisconsin law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Where in Wisconsin?
Well, are you saying that consideration is not required, or are you saying that the continued at-will employment is consideration?
We are saying that a promise of continued at-will employment is sufficient, but if somehow the Court determines that in and of itself it's not, In this case, the fact of substantial subsequent employment supplies any missing consideration.
Promise of continued at-will employment being the converse of, if you don't sign, you have no chance of continued employment.
The if you do not sign is it corresponds to one form of consideration, which is a detriment to the promisee, in this case, the employer. That is, the employer had the right to terminate Mr. Friedland if he had refused to sign. Its forbearance of its exercise of that legal right constitutes lawful consideration. In addition, at the moment it agreed, you know, upon his concurrence, to continue him at will.
I suppose just to keep it uniform, we'd say acceptance.
Yes, acceptance.
Yes.
Upon his acceptance. The employer was, in fact, bound to compensate him pursuant to the agreement for such time as he remained employed. And, in fact, he did remain employed for over 2 years after this covenant was signed.
Does the record indicate why he left?
Why he
left?
I believe he was terminated.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think the question was really implying, is there any evidence in the record of why he was terminated?
I don't believe that the record is developed in detail, but I do believe, and I would defer to counsel on this, but I think that it is uncontested he was terminated for inadequate performance, and there has never been any allegation or evidence that he was terminated for some unlawful or otherwise actionable purpose.
But he doesn't have to be terminated for cause.
There is no requirement in his contract to be terminated for cause, no.
But whether he was terminated for cause or not cause is irrelevant.
I believe it probably is irrelevant in this case. Right. But there's never been an accusation that there was some hidden intent to terminate him instantly upon his execution.
Your arguments on a promise of continuation at will of employment as consideration, and that the employer has a right to terminate and forbearance constitutes legal consideration, goes to your first argument, the first principle, as I understand it.
Yes.
What's your authority for no new consideration needed to modify a contract?
That is Murray versus Hamilton Beach. There is a subsequent Supreme Court decision also cited in our brief that reaffirms that, and at least one additional published Court of Appeals decision that reaffirms those propositions.
Mr. Apfel,
yes.
Don't you have some pretty strong language contrary to your position in Star Direct and in NBZ?
Your Honor, I think not.
You think that language isn't strong, or those cases aren't strong?
Now, clearly I cannot purport to say what this Court was actually doing, but let me operate on the basis of what I read and applying the principles that I know. The issue in Star...
It wouldn't hurt to start by noting how well written.
Magnificent.
Although it's not clear what the Court was doing. Then.
Oh, no, I think it was quite clear.
Let
me tell you how clear it really was.
All right. Okay,
the issue first came up because the employee in Star Direct was arguing that the covenant was not enforceable because it had not been rigorously and uniformly enforced by the employer. The lack of uniformity being that the employer apparently did not enforce it as to existing employees, but did enforce it as to all employees who subsequently came on. And in dispensing with that argument, the Court observed, among other things, that one of the rationale by which an employer could reasonably distinguish between those two groups was that it needed additional consideration for imposing a covenant not to compete on existing employees, citing NBZ. Now, the Court did not purport to say what consideration was necessary. And if you turn to the NBZ court, the court there did not purport to determine really what was sufficient consideration. What the NBZ court did was determine that where the record contained no evidence whatsoever that execution of the covenant not to compete was a prerequisite for continued employment, that no consideration had been given. This case is clearly distinguishable from that. And if I may.
I think I liked the dissent, but that's okay.
Well, I understand. That's both well written.
Oh, yeah,
of course.
Both clear. Both real clear.
I believe if we could, this issue has, for all material purposes, been decided long ago in Wisconsin Ice and Coal Company versus Lewith, in which the court held that a promise of initial at-will consideration or initial at-will employment was sufficient consideration to support a restrictive covenant. And it did so despite an argument that it wasn't sufficient precisely because it was at-will and could have been terminated at any time.
You know, I see these very different. I mean, I don't think Wisconsin Ice is applicable, and I don't know that I wouldn't come out in the same way. I'm listening to what you're telling me. But when you're starting a new employment, the employee gives up nothing by signing the covenant not to compete. This employee gave up 20 years of experience. He had something called restricted services. So he had to not do what he'd done for 20 years under this contract for anybody else. And the guy that's just starting employment doesn't have anything to give up. He hasn't developed skills in this area. And so I really see a great difference. Now, I think that saying that someone that is a continued employee has consideration paid because they didn't get fired, well, you can still fire them at any time. So the employer didn't give up anything. They had that right the day after, as well as the day before the restrictive covenant was signed. But when the employee signs it, he gave up his rights to use a lot of things that he had developed over 20 years. Now, if he had not signed it and gotten fired, he could have gone to work for the same person he's working for right now, correct?
He could have. Okay. He could have, but he decided not to. And let me try, if I may, Your Honor, while I understand that there are distinctions to be made, I think that there are two similarities here. And that the consideration is apparent on both sides of the equation in both cases. In both cases, the detriment to the employer, that is the forbearance, is identical. In both cases, the employer was under no obligation to continue for another moment. And in both cases, the employer decided not to exercise that right and instead...
There wasn't anything to continue for the employer if he hadn't hired the person. What was he continuing or not continuing?
He was giving up the right not to have this person as an employee. This person had no
right. I don't think there's any right to have anyone as an employee.
There's a right to...
There's any right of an employer to have anyone as an employee.
No, but there's a right to not hire.
Every employer has the right to not hire, whether
that's
it's
precise.
At will or you're operating under an employment contract. The employer always has the right to say no thank you.
Mm-hmm. Turning to the employee,
right?
While what the employee gave up and got may be distinguishable in both cases, it is nevertheless real because even the initial employee gives up the opportunity to go to work for someone else right then. The employee narrows his choices.
At-will employment is a long doctrine in Wisconsin. It's a long doctrine, long, long common law doctrine, and we have supported it with many cases in Wisconsin. But what we're talking about here is a restrictive covenant and whether or not there was consideration. Now, we have a long string of cases that say we don't look at the sufficiency of consideration, only whether there is consideration. Okay. So I beg to differ with you. I just don't see Wisconsin Ice here. I'm not sure that I know what the language is in Star Direct. Opposing counsel has run with it, which is reasonable given the position that they're from. But to me, this seems like something that we're going to have to sort out a little bit more here than has been specifically sorted out before.
There are conflicting principles in that they need to be sorted out, and if I may I continue, and perhaps I can help you sort them out.
That would be wonderful.
I do have to note that there are at least seven jurisdictions which have considered the bare promise as sufficient in and of itself, and a host more that have considered the promise plus the fact of continuing employment to be sufficient. I would also point out that there are problems when you try to distinguish between the sufficiency of a promise of initial at-will employment from the sufficiency of a promise of continued at-will employment. First, you have to decide where to draw the line. You know, how long must it have been between the initial employment and the presentation of the covenant not to compete until you are considered an existing employee? And then, how much is enough? And that is, as Your Honor understands, an inquiry that this Court has traditionally hesitated, to delve into. Then there is, of course, that second principle of law, and that is that, in all general contracts, Wisconsin has not heretofore required any consideration to modify it, at least as long as the contract is partially executory, and I don't think there's any question that the contract here is partially executory. And, in fact, if you read the cases and if you read, candidly, our opponent's submissions, I think that underlying the notion that additional consideration is necessary is the assumption that an existing at-will employee has some sort of vested right. But as Your Honor understands, that's not, in fact, true. But let us then turn back to the third principle of law that I think is also determinative here, and that is that even if somehow at that initial moment in time, before anyone had actually moved off the starting line, that no consideration had been given, the fact is that in this case, consideration did in fact flow in the form of at least 2 years of additional employment. Now, the decision of the trial court was clearly driven by what we call the nightmare scenario. That is, that seconds after Mr. Friedland had signed it, the employer would have said, gotcha, pulled the rug out from under him, and left him both without employment and without any compensation for having entered into this agreement. Now, that is not what happened in this case. And as the Seventh Circuit has observed in the case that we quoted in our brief, that is a scenario that is not all that likely to happen. But it's possible. It's possible that it could happen. And so I think this Court has to address, what the remedies are for that sort of nefarious action. And I think the answer is that the remedies are provided by existing law. If, in fact, Runsheimer had turned around seconds after the contract had been entered into and said, aha, gotcha, you're fired, Mr. Friedland would have had a very convincing argument that Runsheimer had entered into that without an intent to actually perform, and in fact had defrauded him, which is a basis to rescind the contract and which would have nullified his obligations.
Could he have argued that he didn't get any consideration?
Could Mr. Friedland have argued?
Yeah.
That he...
If he had been fired right after he signed it.
I think it's a nice question as to whether or not a promise with no intent to perform constitutes consideration or not. I'll yield that point if need be, because it simply wasn't present here. One way or another, a promise made with no intent to perform, under this hypothetical, with affirmative intent to deceive, is not going to be enforceable. This Court won't enforce that. But again, that's not the facts of this case. And Wisconsin courts have, in fact, enforced agreements which at their inception were illusory simply because both parties, or one party or another, had performed and the other had accepted the other's performance. And we've given these cases, first National Bank versus Obie, Hoffman versus Red Owl Stores is a slight variant on it. Even our opponent's authority, Nodal versus Nelson, a case from the Court of Appeals. And if you look at the majority, the vast majority of the cases outside the jurisdiction, the vast majority hold that where there is subsequent performance, actually where there is either a promise or subsequent employment in fact, that they're going to enforce that covenant. Only a small minority say, no, no, neither a promise nor actual performance is sufficient.
No, I think that in interpreting contract law this way, you have to look at what is the easiest thing that will cause the least amount of litigation. And so I ask you, what kind of rule of law here will be the easiest for everyone to understand when they enter into a restrictive covenant, right? And when it's raised as a consideration question here. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I would like to try to attempt to answer that, Your Honor. And
that means you're going to rephrase it so that you can answer it appropriately. Go ahead.
But I'm sure you will then rephrase it for me, ultimately.
You can depend on that, too.
Yes, I can. I can. And actually, let me say that I think there, given the way you have phrased your questions, I would like to answer it in actually two different ways. The second way, of which is the really easy answer, although not one that I endorse. The first way is, I think, an answer that is consistent with established principles of Wisconsin law, and it has, and bear with me, please, three components. The first component is recognition that determination of the sufficiency of consideration supporting a covenant not to compete is governed by the same rules governing all other contracts in Wisconsin. The second component is that the sufficiency of consideration is determined at the time plaintiff seeks to enforce the contract. And the third is that in the absence of fraud or any other recognized grounds for avoidance of a contract, a promise of continued at-will employment followed by a substantial period of employment is sufficient.
Well, go ahead.
Would you like to hear the more rough justice approach?
Sure.
Okay.
We're the wild Midwest.
We will not enforce covenants not to compete for a period longer than the period that has expired between the execution and the termination.
Interesting, because he was terminated 2 years, and 2 years slightly, is the longest time
slightly more
that he
than
has
two years.
To refrain in this agreement.
Yes, slightly more than 2 years. Well, in fact, Your Honor, 2 years, 2 years is a fairly standard covenant not to compete.
Well, and no one has. He was fired in 2 years. I was just responding to your comment to the Chief Justice.
He was fired. It was more than 2 years, but.
Well, but you didn't. You didn't count the time in terms of what the restrictive covenant time is. You're saying restrictive covenant won't be enforced for any longer time,
yes,
regardless of what the terms of the restrictive covenant are.
Now, there are problems with that.
Yep.
The first problem is, what if the employee terminates? I don't think that rule does justice in that case. And the second problem is, it does not protect confidential information. Because an employee could gain confidential information on the very first day.
I'll tell you what I think is the rougher justice.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a flat rule. That is that promise under an at-will arrangement that's not adequate consideration, then you don't have a fight. You can't come to court. It's a flat rule. If the employer wants a restrictive covenant, he can change the contract or the arrangement with the employee, I should say, from at will to a contract for a period of years. I mean, it's all in the employer's control and care, and if he really thinks this employee has this kind of information and has this kind of wherewithal to compete with him, you give him a contract. And that's a flat rule that is easy, won't have litigation. It also fits with the public policy of the state, which is the legislation in Wisconsin does not favor restrictive covenants. It's a very tough law. If you go over what's reasonable under the statute, you are out as the employer. I mean, you are out from enforcing a restrictive covenant. That's very tough. Most states don't have that kind of rule. They have a reasonableness rule. So in order to comply with the legislative public policy underlying it, you just say no. What about that rough, Justice? Rough enough?
I think, Your Honor, I think it's a little too rough for my
taste. That's what I figured.
Yes, and if you bear with me, could I respond at least two reasons why it's a little too rough?
Right.
The first reason is that, you know, I think that it gets the court involved in making value determinations that are ordinarily left to the free market. It will also come as an enormous surprise to a vast number of employers in the state of Wisconsin who currently are probably operating under such an assumption. Now, Your Honor, I see my red light is on.
Well, surprises are okay, Mr. Hapfeld.
There could be some people who would disagree with that, particularly.
Well, it depends whether the surprise is in their favor or not.
Yes, I understand that.
You may respond in just a couple of sentences because you will have 5 minutes.
Well, I think that the final point to be made is that I'm not sure that rule of law has been adopted by a single other jurisdiction.
It's a good place to start.
Well, I'm afraid I would beg to differ, but I will sit down for the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Hapfeld. Mr. Rosen. Welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honors. It's an honor to be here, and may it please the Court. My name is Jeffrey Rosen. I'm from the Boston office of Constangi Brooks & Smith. Another defendant in this case was Corporate Reimbursement Services, is Corporate Reimbursement Services, and that is a Massachusetts company. That is the company that hired Mr. Friedland. Consistent with Your Honor, Chief Justice's last question, the rule that Your Honor proposes is also consistent with the precedent Star Direct v. Dalpra, which myself, Wisconsin counsel from Constangi, and Mr. Friedland's personal counsel reviewed when he was fired by Runzheimer and sought employment, reached out to CRS, Corporate Reimbursement Services, and sought employment by CRS in Massachusetts. We looked at these issues. We looked at this precedent, which frankly is very well written, and I want to point to a couple places where it is in particular. And as is the concurrence / dissent, no place in the opinion are we talking about dicta when we say that existing employees must receive something additional.
Mr. Rosen, there are a lot of cases in Wisconsin that say there's no such thing as dicta.
And I understand that. Thank you, Your Honor. And I don't mean to use that term loosely, but
there are a lot of cases that say there is no dicta, too, so you can pick your group of cases.
Correct, Your Honor. And we are aware of that precedent and cited it in our brief to the Court of Appeals, which we've adopted here. We look at that language and we say, okay, Mr. Friedland, continued employment doesn't appear to be sufficient consideration for this non-compete that you signed. Did you receive something extra? Did you receive something extra like Mr. Dalpra received, a $30,000 bonus to stay for 30 months Did you receive a contract for continued employment? That would be something extra. No, you didn't. What you received was the right, supposedly, a right that you've always had, an expectation you've always had that goes right into the offer letter you had for your position, to have the exact same compensation you've always had. It was undisputed below, and it's undisputed here, that Mr. Friedland would have been terminated if he did not sign the non-compete, which means necessarily that the incentive compensation participation was not something additional. There was no right for Mr. Friedland to continue his employment but not participate in the incentive plan. Because of that fact, it is undisputed that there was nothing additional. That aside, the fact that Mr. Friedland got to participate in the incentive plan every year, and it was part of his offer letter and part of his compensation and inextricably part of his compensation package at Runsheimer, it wasn't additional. When I look at the Mr. Friedland had independent counsel at the time that he sought to apply for the job. He received an opinion from that. We gave Corporate Reimbursement Services an opinion, and we looked at this language. Non-competes should be construed in favor of the employee here. Non-competes that cross that line, we won't blue pencil here. We will strike them or part of them completely. And in DALPRA, paragraph 20 of this court's opinion, this court talked about pre- and post-termination non-compete agreements. It mentions the words pre and post, but it did not mention anything about current term restrictive covenants until it gave that language that we looked at and that we're talking about, where it said, in fact, employers may not compel their existing employees to sign restrictive covenants without additional consideration. Because of that, Corporate Reimbursement Services was willing to go forward. David Friedland took a chance and said, I'm going to take this new job. I think I can do it. I think I can do it under Wisconsin law. And then he became a sales representative for Corporate Reimbursement Services. But there was a lawsuit, and with every lawsuit comes the threat of damages. And with the threat of damages becomes deterrence to whether you go out and you do your very best, call on all those customers that maybe you shouldn't be calling on because they were former Runsheimer customers. Maybe you shouldn't even be going to that other jurisdiction because you did help an employee in that other jurisdiction, and there's really broad language in this restrictive covenant agreement you signed. So all of a sudden, your ability to fully perform, your reliance on this language, your ability to fully perform is in jeopardy. And Mr. Friedland, unfortunately, was not able to fully perform to his capacity at Corporate Reimbursement Services. And he was terminated in the fall of 2013, late summer of 2013. That's what has happened to him. But, Your Honor,
change the facts a little bit. And under your principles of law, Mr. Friedland is either fired or terminated or whatever it is. But suppose the company was very happy with him. They had employed him for over 2 years, and he just voluntarily left because he thought because he had been talking to what's his name?
Corporate Reimbursement
Services. Yeah, Corporate Reimbursement Services. Does that make any difference?
Your Honor, we don't think it would. We don't think it would because you either have a contract that's supported by consideration or you don't. Many courts are starting to look at the issue of if an employer terminates an employee and it's for not a good reason, not for cause, can the employer enjoy the fruits of the non-compete that the employee signed? Is it in a better position than when an employee resigns and walks away? Other courts are looking at the issue of if you take something away from an employee during their employment, do you invalidate their restrictive covenants that they signed at the start? Okay? Those are issues that don't address what's at issue in this case, which is, was there something that Mr. Friedland got when he signed that was any different than what he already had and already had a right to? And one of the facts that's in this case that also go to the contract being an illusory promise and the consideration being illusory is that this incentive compensation plan, it's undisputed it wasn't even drafted and finalized and presented to him at the time he had to sign the non-compete. He didn't know what was in it. But Runsheimer readily concedes, and it's in the record at 71 and 72 in the appendix, readily concedes that this incentive plan wasn't drafted with the restrictive covenant agreement in mind. So something additional, Chief Justice Abramson, would be giving the employee a better incentive plan, one with a higher bonus structure, something additional, something you don't usually get. Hey, everybody, sign this new restrictive covenant agreement that's really important to us because we have these very strong protectable interests, and we're actually going to give you something real for it.
Even
that's
if it,
an employer, excuse me, Your Honor.
Even if it continues to be at will, I mean, I can promise him the moon. It's still at will, which means I can fire him tomorrow.
Correct, Your Honor. That's why there needs to be something additional. That's why 16 other states find there must be something additional.
The Baylor Law Review that I have in front of me, which dates to 2006, says, in effect, that Texas does have the proposal that does have as law by the court, the proposal I made that under no circumstances can the promise of a future at-will relationship serve as consideration. So it's at least one state that says that.
Correct, Your Honor. And Pennsylvania is another state. And I have a list of other states here under a quick survey, and I count 16 of them, that require something additional. Pennsylvania says that something additional must be something like a salary increase, something more than de minimis. And I have the cite for Your Honor. In Pennsylvania, that cite is Maintenance Specialties versus GOTIS, 314A2D279. 279, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court from 1974. And yes, there are a number of states that say that continued employment is sufficient consideration. One of them is my own state, Massachusetts. And what is happening in Massachusetts now? It passed the House but didn't quite get past the Senate, a legislative bill to stop that from happening. That's not fair to the employee.
Counsel, what about your opposing counsel's assertion that forbearance of exercising a legal right, in other words, in this instance, the employer refraining from terminating constitutes consideration. That's one part. The second part is a variation of the question, one of the questions that the Chief Justice posed to your opposing counsel, which is, and I think you may have just answered it, but I want to make sure it's comprehensive. What is the rule that you want to have emerge from this? And I think, I don't know if it's limited to what you just said. There has to be something, as you say, extra. And then finally, it's three, yeah. What's your response to the assertion that forbearance is consideration? And what rule do you want to have emerge from this case? And how will both of your answers square with the axiomatic principle that was recently reaffirmed in a Wisconsin case, Town of Waukesha versus 164 of Waukesha Limited, and it's very brief, and it's not going to be a surprise to you. and it instructs courts that in deciding whether there is consideration to support a contract, we are not concerned with the adequacy of the consideration, but with the existence of legal consideration, because the adequacy in fact, as distinguished from value in law, is for the parties to judge for themselves.
Thank you, Your Honor. In addressing your first question, the forbearance point, the question, I believe, is answered by Your Honor's opinion in DALPRA, where the specific language says, employers may not compel their existing employees. So the only way, other than perhaps the unlawful way of a gun to a head, the only way to compel an employee to...
Without, as you've quoted it in full before, without additional consideration.
Right. But that word compel, it has to do with forbearance, because what it means is that the employee is forced to sign something. And the employer, the compulsion that they're engaging in, isn't giving something and isn't giving something up. It's, on one hand, Your Honor views it as possibly you're giving up your right to fire someone, but you're actually not, because you as an employer can fire that person the very next day. To Your Honor's second question, the rule that we would like to emerge from this is that rule that we feel like was stated in DALPRA clearly. Continued employment is not sufficient consideration for restrictive covenants when it is the only consideration given to existing employees.
And how does that mesh with the principle that we don't look, what constitutes, what are we supposed to look for? You're giving a solid and clear declaration of what we're not supposed to look for. You know, don't consider continued employment alone sufficient additional consideration. But how do we look for consideration without getting into the business of deciding what's adequate?
Excuse me, Your Honor. The issue of the sufficiency of consideration versus the adequacy theoretically could always go to the party's state of mind. What was Mr. Friedland thinking here? What was Runsheimer thinking here was adequate?
I don't understand.
Mr. Friedland, do you view this consideration as adequate? I believe Your Honor's question went to, we don't look to the sufficiency of consideration, but to what's adequate, and what is adequate depends on what the party's view is adequate.
Let me try it this way. If they had come to him and said, we'd like to offer you a bonus or a payment of $10,000, or $30,000 as in Star Direct, would that be sufficient to meet your test?
It would, Your Honor.
How about $3,000?
It would.
$300,000?
Possibly. I think this court should fashion a rule like Pennsylvania fashioned. A de minimis rule, something material. Granted, material leads to litigation, but something that is credibly viewed as the party's additional. $100 Best Buy gift card for every employee that signs a restrictive covenant is probably going to be met with the employee by the employees with, you know, that doesn't measure up to me having to give up my 20 years of expertise. And the employee, and that's...
I bet you they'd take it because they want to keep on working. That's what I bet you.
There is a very tough burden put on employees in that situation, mm-hmm. which is why the rule here that we saw, which we think is a rule here and hope is a rule here, is so fair. Your Honors, I had a few other points. I can continue or address any further questions.
I have a question. Suppose in the initial employment, well, I'm going to hire you, you are an employee at will. You understand that means I can fire you for no reason or any reason. I can't fire you for an illegal reason. You understand that. And as part of the agreement that I hire you as an employee at will, I want you to sign this restrictive covenant. Is there consideration for that?
Your Honor's question had to do specifically with hiring?
Mm-hmm.
I think there absolutely is, because the applicant, the hiree, is getting something additional. They are getting a job, benefits, whatever comes with that.
So it's a promise for a promise. I hire you at will, which means I can fire you tomorrow, and you agree to come and work for me, and I can fire you at any time. But you, but I also have to agree that for this two-year restrictive covenant, right?
Correct.
All right. So what's so different? Now I'm working for you for 2 years or 5 years, and you come to me and say, remember, you're an at-will employee, if I do. And you say, you know I can fire you at any time. Yes, I understand that. And you say, okay, I want to continue you at will, but I want you to sign this restrictive covenant. Why is that any different than the first case I gave you? And, I mean, that's the position, if I understand it, of Runsheimer.
Your Honor, it's a difficult question to answer. The
one that's presented in this case, isn't it?
It is. And, Your Honors, here in this state where employees and restrictive covenant agreements are scrutinized and viewed in the light most favorable to the employee, here, this state, we thought recognized and should recognize that those employees, in Your Honor's second hypothetical, should be given something more because there's an inherent situation of unequal bargaining power, of unequal forbearance. The employer, in effect, doesn't change its daily life. And it's better for the employer. In fact, if the employees that already know its business, already know how things work, don't need to be trained, can just simply stay. They don't have to go out and find a recruiter to find someone as talented. The employer gets nothing new other than a very serious restriction on an employee. And what does the employee get? Nothing new and a very serious restriction on them, which is something that's very non-employee friendly when it comes to restrictive, looking at how you look at a restrictive covenant. In this case, we don't just have these arguments on consideration. We have the arguments that each of the restrictive covenants, the confidentiality, the non-solicit, and the non-compete, were all also overbroad. The non-solicit literally could require Mr. Friedland not to call on any customer that Runsheimer ever had for 80 years. The confidentiality restriction literally said, if we mark it confidential or if we treat it confidential, it's confidential. What does it mean if you treat it confidential? Does that mean you marked it and you did something else?
Did Mr. Friedland sign a confidentiality agreement when he went to work for CSI?
CRS, Your Honor?
Thank you.
Is that in the record?
That is not in the record.
Don't tell me then. Okay. Thank you.
I hear you giving us the Pennsylvania rule.
I feel like I'm giving you your rule, but I feel like I'm giving you the Pennsylvania additional guidance on it when you ask the questions about what is additional. Something more than de minimis, a salary increase, that nature.
Well, Pennsylvania, and I'm looking at maintenance specialties versus Goddess. It says that initially, it's the example I gave you, initially if there's an employment relationship beginning, you can add on a restrictive covenant because the very fact that you're offering employment and the other person is taking it is sufficient consideration. But then they say that once the employment starts, that there has to be a change of status. You have to create something new in order to add on the restrictive covenant. And that's what I think I hear you asking to be the rule.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
You know, counsel, I wonder, as I'm listening to the conversation, I'm rereading, I wonder if the reason that we are all, it seems to me, a little bit struggling with this concept is bound up in the whole concept of at-will employment. In at-will employment, it seems to me there's a symmetry of, if not bargaining power, the bargaining power of the respective parties is going to be dictated by the marketplace. I mean, what a Derek Jeter several years ago could have commanded, you know, his bargaining power was pretty good. And it seems to me with at-will employment, there's a certain symmetry. The employer, if things aren't working out to the employer's satisfaction or the employer has to cut back for financial reasons, they have to make the decision to let somebody go. On the other hand, if the employee finds a better opportunity or for whatever reason finds it to their advantage or is forced to leave, we do not force or we do not award damages to the employer for the loss of a star employee, no pun intended. And so, yes, it's true what you said earlier, that the employer here could have fired him the next day, but had he received a better offer, Mr. Friedland could have left the next day. So I guess it's not a very pointed question, but it's an honest one. What's your response?
Well, in the context of at-will employment, it is true that both parties on one day at any particular time and under a different set of factual circumstances could have equal bargaining power.
Please note, I did not say symmetrical bargaining power. That will depend. But symmetrical right to terminate the relationship. That's what I meant.
Right, Your Honor. However, in the situation of an employee presented with a document that will or could change the course of their career if they don't sign it, will or change the course of their family's financial future if they don't sign it and end up fired, is a very different situation where the symmetry is not there. Now, if the employer said, in 6 months, everybody, I'm going to have everybody sign a non-compete, and you have 6 months to find a job, because if you don't, you'll be fired if you don't sign it. That's an employer behaving in a very different way, which leads me to another point in this case. When Runsheimer was aware of what this court said in DALPRA, it said there's two forms of consideration in this non-compete. One, continued employment. Two, the incentive plan.
To what?
The incentive plan.
Oh, yes, right.
But yet, they readily acknowledged the incentive plan had nothing to do with the non-compete. The incentive plan was no different because of the non-compete. They readily acknowledged you would have been fired if you didn't sign it, so the incentive plan is irrelevant. So they tried to draft an agreement that was fair. But for a guy that participated in the incentive plan every year and for every witness who testified to acknowledge that this was a part of being an employee here, being a part of the incentive plan, Runsheimer was giving nothing.
If they would have fired him because he's an at-will employee, and then the next week or day, said, you know, I wish we wouldn't have fired you. We want to hire you back. and then they present him with the contract, the non-compete. Would you be arguing that he didn't receive consideration when they said, as a condition of your employment, you have to sign this?
I would address that question in two ways, Your Honor. Number one, I would say, in that scenario, where someone is now being hired a week later and getting something that they've now lost, they've lost something, and they now need to get something back, bargaining power is a lot more equal, and yes, that would be enforceable. But I would.
Your point isn't that you need additional consideration, then. Your point isn't that an at-will employee can never sign these because there's no additional consideration. You're losing me a little bit here.
Well, it is in this way. Counsel for Runsheimer argues that if you do that, it creates a perverse incentive for employers to just fire employees just simply to rehire them.
Right, which you said would work. I mean,
wouldn't that be a ruse if that were the case? Wouldn't that be a way to circumvent the law that requires you to give employees something additional?
Well, you're required to give an employee what? You lost me again. What were they required to give the employee? They could have given him his walking papers.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. So this employee wasn't in a bargaining position. This employee was going to either keep his job or not. So, I mean, if they were just from scratch, let me just ask you this. They didn't have this existing employment relationship, but he came in and he said, hey, I'm really good at this job. I want this job. And they said, okay, we'll hire you, but you have to sign this non-compete. But you're an at-will employee. Would you be making the arguments you're making today?
I would not, Your Honor. I think every state, including this one, agrees that upon hire, someone is getting something additional. An employee is getting something additional, and a restrictive covenant has consideration.
Okay.
It's both sufficient and adequate.
So the fact that he was kept on to you is very different and distinct from being hired in the first instance.
It is, Your Honor, under the way that I have at least viewed, and I'm probably the one in the room with the least authority on the subject, your statutes, your precedent, and the facts of DALPRA.
I just wanted to make sure I understood whether, you know, I'm going to figure out whether I think that's consistent or not, but I wanted to make sure I fully understood your argument.
I understand, Your Honor.
Were all employees at Runsheimer asked to sign a restrictive covenant?
That is in the record, Your Honor, yes. And with that, my red light has gone off.
Before you sit down,
Ms. Rogan's back.
Is part of your argument that the consideration for signing this agreement, the employer got much more than the employee got? I mean, the employee got to continue work. He didn't get fired. But the employer got to protect business interests that it hadn't sought protection for before. Is there necessary to be some kind of a balance between one side and the other?
I would answer that, Your Honor, by saying here the employer got something for nothing.
Can I ask one more question? I just want to be clear. You're not asking us to send this back because it's overly broad. You're just here arguing this consideration issue. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry. That's not right. I'm asking for Your Honors to review that issue and the entire record and that any of those bases can support affirming the lower court's decision.
Okay. Thank you.
Is that necessarily so, what you said, that the employee is giving something up? Because maybe this employee, and I'm not talking about Mr. Friedland, I'm talking about the next case that'll be similar. What if that is the best salesperson ever in the history of the company? And the employer walks in and says, hey, you know, you've been with us for a long time, and you've been doing a stellar job, but, you know, we have developed these things over the years that we want to protect. We ask you to sign this. And the employee says, no, I might get a better offer tomorrow, and I don't want to be restricted by this. I'm not going to sign.
Correct, Your Honor, and in fact, that's what happened. Well, the root salesman in DALPRA because he was so valuable, was given $30,000.
Right.
Because they feared that he wouldn't sign it.
Right.
Counsel, the trial court and the Court of Appeals did not, as I understand it, determine whether this was good under the statute, that is, this restrictive covenant should be complying with the statute. And that's really a factual and legal question, but you have to have facts about what might be reasonable, right?
It is, Your Honor.
And isn't this here on summary judgment?
It is, Your Honor. And on summary judgment, we made all of those arguments.
And did you put in affidavits and other material that would support the factual issues here?
We did, Your Honor, the testimony from, in particular, Mr. Harper, president of Runsheimer, as to how they interpreted the restrictive covenants, the non-compete, the non-solicit, and the confidentiality. That is all in the summary judgment record.
And therefore, in your conclusion on page 50 of your brief, you asked for, as an alternative ground, to dismiss the claims on the basis of the overbroad and unreasonable under the statute.
Correct,
you think this court should make the decision rather than go back to the Court of Appeals or trial court?
We do, Your Honor, because that would be the most efficient way to proceed here with a fully developed record.
Thank you, counsel. I'm sorry, Justice Brodsky.
Suppose, Mr. Rosen, you and Mr. Barker were the two super sales people for Runsheimer. You explained to me that everybody in the company signed a restrictive covenant, so that Mr. Barker also signed it. Don't you benefit by having him sign a restrictive covenant so that he can't leave and take trade secrets with him and inform everybody in a competitor? I mean, you're left. I mean,
if you looked at the facts that way, absolutely, Your Honor. If you looked at the facts that way. However, here...
Why can't I look at the facts that way?
Well, Your Honor, because to us, that is speculative consideration. It would be also inadequate. Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Apfeld.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I would like to apologize in advance for what I doubtless will be a haphazard presentation, but I will attempt to respond to a number of things that have come up before. And the first thing is a question of terminology, of phrasing. Counsel suggests that the question is whether or not the consideration given was adequate in comparison to what Mr. Friedland had before. And that, conceptually, is simply not the correct question. The question is whether the consideration he received was sufficient to support what he got by signing. And as to that, you compare where he would have been had he not signed. And it is undisputed on this record that had he not signed, Mr. Friedland would have been unemployed. Instead, he was employed for 2 years.
Well, and also the employer would have had an employee out there that could get hired by the same person who hired him, but with no strings on his performance.
That too, is a possibility. And Mr. Friedland was presented with that choice.
Counsel, when you touch upon the issues of sufficiency or adequacy, that implicates, in my mind, the whole issue of reasonableness. The Court of Appeals in its certification on page 4 characterizes your argument as asking this, that continued at-will employment can suffice as consideration, but only after a court evaluates the circumstances occurring after the restrictive covenant was signed to determine whether the agreement was reasonable.
It goes on in the next paragraph to say adopting this rule would require that Wisconsin make an exception to the traditional rule that the law does not inquire into the adequacy of the consideration to support a promise, only its existence. Is the Court of Appeals correctly characterizing your argument?
I can do no better than to tell you what our position is. Our position is, first and foremost, that a promise of continued at-will employment is in and of itself sufficient consideration. But if it is not, then the fact of substantial additional employment acquiesced in by both parties is sufficient.
And the question there is reasonableness? I mean, that's the way they carry, after the restrictive covenant was signed, to determine whether the agreement was reasonable. That's how they characterize it.
I don't think that reasonableness is the operative inquiry. I think if you are to measure substantiality, it must be of a length sufficient to dispel any an implication of bad faith or fraud in the inducement.
In fact, I thought I saw in your brief that the idea of reasonableness of the covenant not to compete is not relevant to this appeal.
That is, if I recollect correctly, it was our position that the reasonableness of the restrictions themselves should not be considered on appeal. And I do believe that the trial court didn't render any decision on it. Even though defendants moved for summary judgment, frankly, it is, you know, generally a question of fact. It has to do, among other things, with the effect on the employee, as well as the overall necessity of such a restriction for purposes of protecting the employer's interest. And in that regard, I do have to correct opposing counsel in one respect. He said that whether or not Mr. Friedland had to sign a covenant not to compete with CRS is not in the record. It, in fact, is in the record. If you look at our appendix, page 85 and following, you will see a copy of that which was produced. And I do not need to blow up this copy to demonstrate to you from the bench that it is a very interesting one indeed. You can tell that virtually every provision has been redacted. And I will also suggest to you that the contents, the actual contents of that, which we have yet to learn, would be highly material in determining what a like-situated competitive enterprise deems is necessary to protect its own interests. I do not think that the reasonableness of these restrictions should be considered at this stage of the proceedings, but if the Court wants to, we have already addressed this at length in our briefs.
You addressed it, I think, only in your reply brief.
Only in our reply brief. That is correct.
Counsel, I know the red light is on, but I'd like to ask you about, I want to go back to consideration. You said that the continued employment, the promise of continued at-will employment, I think you used the word sufficient, was sufficient consideration. I'm a little concerned. Let me finish. you'll be happy that you did.
You win.
I think. I don't know. But that brings me back to the Waukesha case. In deciding whether there is consideration to support a contract, we are not concerned with the adequacy. So when you say sufficiency, you simply mean there is some consideration, and we as a court or any court, I think if I grasp your argument, you're saying, look, there is consideration. Court, the longstanding rule is you don't get involved in whether it was sufficient, whether it was fair, whether it was reasonable, whether it was symmetrical with what the employer got. As long as there's some, it passes the test.
That is correct. My choice of the word sufficient was inartful. It should have simply been lawful consideration.
Just wanted to make sure.
Yes. Your Honors, I see that my red light is on. May I indulge the Court in a couple of very brief points?
Very briefly.
Very brief. First is opposing counsel made some representation about 16 jurisdictions holding in his favor. I don't think either I or opposing counsel attempted to canvass all authorities. I would direct this Court to an annotation at 51 ALR 3rd 825, which in its updated version, according to my count, has 33 jurisdictions addressing this issue, of which 26 would enforce this covenant under one rationale or another. And again, realizing that my time has already expired, I would make...
Before you go on, ALR 3rd, what page?
You 825.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thank you. Realizing that my time has expired, two more points. The first, in addressing Justice Abramson's suggested rule, I would note that the very power of the statute, Section 103.465, the very power of the statute to invalidate unreasonable restrictions makes it less important to differentiate between the type of consideration that will support this covenant from the type of consideration that will support any other contract. And the final point, and I would suggest to you that before you create any particular rule, special rule or exception applicable to this case, consider the fact that there have been a number of decisions from this court that have upheld employer promises to employees despite the absence of initial consideration given for those promises on the basis of the employee's subsequent performance. If subsequent performance of an employment at-will agreement is not sufficient consideration to support an employee's covenant not to compete, will it be sufficient? Will an employee's performance be sufficient to enforce that employer's promises? If we are looking for some nature of symmetry and consistency in the law, I think that the answer is both performances will support both types of promises. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Apfeld, and thank you, Mr. Rosen. We'll get another argument on restrictive covenants in this state, but coming in a different fact situation in raising the issue of consideration, which, as I remember, Professor McCauley at the UW Law School thought was a dead issue. So when we finish this and release the opinion, I will send it to Professor McCauley. That concludes our hearing in 2013 AP 1392, Brunsheimer International versus David Friedland. The court will gather in the conference room at 3:20. Thank you.